right, so this is sixth class, I believe, or the sixth class I've done. James did one as well, on The Intimate Way of Zen by James Ford. And I keep on meaning to pull up the Oxfording pictures for review. Let me see if I can pull them up real quick. Fair. It's always tricky navigating two windows on a small laptop. Sharing is not turned on. Who is our host? Tyler? Can you make sharing available for all?
Yes, I can do that. Sorry. Shared, how do I? Did make you.
Well, if you click under share and you click allow multiple people to share at once, then it
Oh,
just
there it
like
is. Yeah, okay, thank you.
it's a blanket permission.
That go there
Cool.
for you.
All right. So just to review, because we keep on talking about these Oxfording pictures. So there they are. So that's the first one is searching for the ox. Next one is finding the footprints. The third is seeing the ox. The fourth is catching the ox. The fifth is taming. Then we have riding the ox home, the ox forgotten, forget both self and ox, return to the origin, and entering the marketplace with extended hands. So these are pictures that symbolize different stages in our spiritual search. The ox being the mystery or the liberation or the awakening that we are drawn to search for. So at first we don't know where that ox, if maybe even the ox exists. We're not quite sure what we're searching for, but we find evidence, finding the footprints, and then the chapters that we're talking about tonight are kind of under seeing the ox. Actually, it's not all that relevant to what we're talking about tonight, but I always figure we'd start with that. Actually, what we're talking about tonight doesn't seem very related to that at all. But the two chapters that were on the list for tonight, chapters 10 and 11. So chapter 10 was about the three poisons, and 11 was about the five hindrances. So these are traditional lists taken from original Buddhism, and James Ford offers them as useful tools on our practice and gives us kind of a Zen take on them. So I was going to talk about them. I'm just kind of lumping them all together. And these lists, both the two lists, overlap somewhat, and even within the list, perhaps. But I would say just don't worry about it. The three poisons, the five hindrances, many other lists in Buddhism. Are like different ways of slicing the Dharma tomato. It's the same tomato, but you can just kind of, dice it up and slice it up a little bit differently. So trying to make these things all correlate can be kind of maddening. So the three poisons, and oh yeah, just a note about the purpose of lists. And these are really about really meant to be an aid in mindfulness, not a reason to feel guilty or inadequate. So they're not lists of sins in a way that we need to, like, confess to and beat ourselves up about or something like that. These are, I think it's, and I'll talk more about this in a bit, but it's kind of like sometimes. As we experience in the course of our education, right, that we don't even notice things sometimes until until they are named and pointed out to us. You know, a classic example is you can have spent your whole life just hearing bird song and it's just bird song. But if you actually learn a little bit about birds and the sounds they make, then suddenly you realize like there's a whole like soap opera of bird life going on out there. So this is a way of pointing out to us different things to look for and attune ourselves to, because then it is useful. It's useful to notice these things. So the three poisons are considered the root. One or more of these are at the root of all. And well, sometimes we'll say the word evil. It doesn't have the same connotations that it does in Judeo-Christianity or whatever, that like there's truly evil forces or evil people. Evil is selfishness and harmfulness. So the source of all suffering, the source of all of the mess that we make of our lives and of the world. So that includes, you often hear greed, hate, and delusion as a shortcut for it, but I'm going to go into a little bit more. So we have lobha, which is craving, desire, or grasping. So this is something that we like and want and feel we need. And we run into things that we like and want and enjoy and are nourishing and helpful, and that's fine and natural. But at what point is something pleasant or good or sustaining? At what point do we cross the line into craving or grasping? And I think of this as, you know, basically, if we don't get what we want, we suffer. So then, of course, we have the flip of that, which is dosha or dvesha, aversion, sometimes, you know, translated as aversion, hatred, or anger, but it's really aversion. Something we don't like or feel threatened by is present, and we don't want it to be. So, as at what point does a this is a kind of a koan for all of us? What does a natural response of, you know, anger or you know, this thing needs to change or something? What at what point does that become internal insistence or resistance? Where as long as that things aren't the way we want them to be, we add dukkha to the unpleasantness. And then there's moha, often translated as delusion, ignorance, a state of belief in something false. I really loved James Ward's take on this. He said, what I've come to understand moha is as certainty. It is, in fact, the constellation of our certainties. Anything we are sure of absolutely without a hint of a doubt, and where that certainty cannot be challenged, that is moha. That was very interesting.
They're sad. I don't remember reading that at all. Got it.
So it's actually, we may end up returning to that a little bit, but I really want to concentrate on the five hindrances tonight. And so I'll give a heads up to Tyler that we will be breaking into small groups for a little while at some point. So that would be three or four people per room. Because we're going to talk about the five hindrances, which, like I said, they seem like they kind of overlap with the three poisons a little bit, but I was thinking about these, and I was thinking about that when we discussed them, what they were, I was just going to break out, and each group would get, you know, a poison or a hindrance, but the poison are kind of more, they're less specific. They're kind of like an underlying theme, if you will. And the hindrances are something that is, they're easy to identify the arising in our life and therefore to understand them and address them. So the first of these, and I will go ahead and pass these out in the Zendo, dirt Zendo, and then for the cloud, I will share my little list of these things. So I will put the link in the chat if that's the way you prefer to look at these things, because then you can just kind of pull it up and control it yourself. So this is a link of the hindrances with some definitions. I will also share for those of you who want that. And if you don't want to see my shared screen, if you're not aware of this in Zoom, there should be a little like stop share thing up front, and like my sharing will go away and you can see everybody again and control this yourself. So in the Zendo, you could stop share because everybody has their little handout this time. Right.
Say that though.
Where is that?
Isn't it at the very top of the screen? There's a little band of controls, and then you are screen sharing. Oh no, maybe you can't stop.
There's a share on the bottom.
I think you can change the. There ought to be some way for you to not see it anymore.
Drag.
I can just drag it to be really small.
Yeah.
All right. Well, okay. So, by the way, I've listened to some of the classes and talks, and when you're listening to the recording, this part is really boring.
What part is?
Hold on, wait. I don't know. Can I see it? Do you have that link? All right. So the first hindrance is worldly obsession or kamachanda. It's often translated as sense desire. But I think sometimes we think of that as too limited. We think of that as like, ooh, I like sensual pleasure, or like, you know, I don't know. Massages and fine oils and delicious restaurant food or something, and that it includes that, but it's not just about pleasure. It's basically desire for anything that you can perceive with your senses. And in the Buddhist view, your mind is a sense that senses thoughts. So this is a quote that I really like. This is Ajahn Brahmavamsa from a essay called The Five Hindrances. He said, in the Pali term kamachanda, chanda is what you have to do if you cannot attend a meeting of the community of monks and you want to give approval and agreement to what's happening there. You give your chanda to go ahead in your absence. It's agreement, approval, consent. So this is much more subtle than mere desire, mere liking or enjoying. This means that you are buying into, giving into this. You want it. You approve of it. You allow it to happen. In the same way we have chanda in the Vinaya, we have kamachanda. It's as if you give your approval for the sensory world to be in your consciousness, in your mind. You accept it, approve of it, you play with it. That's all chanda. It's letting it completely occupy the mind. So I like letting objects of your desire completely occupy the mind. Then we have vipada or ill will. And I like throwing in the Pali there, not that I don't have this memorized, and I'm not suggesting any of you should, but I like it as a little reminder that all of the words that we're offering are translations of these terms, and probably don't really convey the full thing in one English word. Ill will ranging from subtle irritation and dislike to bitter resentment to fury that can fuel aggression and violence, can take the form of a specific fantasy of revenge or a conscious wish for someone to get their comeuppance, but it can also take the form of more general, vague lack of goodwill. Ill will can be aimed at anyone, specific people, groups of people, human institutions, a nameless and faceless other who is to blame, or ourselves. So then we have Tinha Midha, sloth and torpor. And Ford calls this half-hearted engagement. We're caught by the hindrance of sloth when we lose interest in making a positive effort. Sloth is a conscious choice to give up striving and instead indulge ourselves in what's easy and comfortable. Sloth could also be called laziness, which from a Buddhist point of view is failure to apply what we know to be wholesome. I love that definition, right? It's not just kind of like a, because it implies like you know better. That's what makes it lazy. It's like you're going like, but. So torpor then follows sloth. Our lack of effort leads to a dullness of mind and body, which in turn makes us feel even less inclined to make an effort. Therefore, these two factors, sloth and torpor, are seen as a pair that always occur together. So sloth hyphen torpor. Then we have an interesting one, restlessness and worry. So this is another like hyphenated udacha kukucha, or disquiet, agitation, remorse. So the first one, the restlessness. So Bhikkhu Bodhi defines these terms in a comprehensive manual of Abhidhamma. It says restlessness or udacha has the characteristic of disquietude, like water whipped up by the wind. Its function is to make the mind unsteady, as wind makes a banner ripple. It manifests as turmoil. Its proximate cause is unwise attention to mental disquiet. And then worry, or kukucha, is worry or remorse after having done wrong. Its characteristic is subsequent regret. Its function is to sorrow over what has and what has not been done. It is manifested as remorse. Its proximate cause is what has or has not been done. So it might be helpful to think of these as two separate hindrances, but when I was trying to get my mind around, like, why are these put together? I was thinking this is all of our compulsive fault finding and problem solving. Like, this is the mind, like, compared to the other hindrances, this is all our, like, this kind of stuff. And I also, I appreciate how, so it's kind of obvious, like worldly obsession, ill will, sloth and torpor, those you can kind of, it's pretty obvious. You're like, oh yeah, that's probably going to get in the way of my meditation and practice. But I like how the restlessness and worry, including this remorse about the past, this is a hindrance. It's not like, this is something that you should be doing, is beating yourself up. But like, if you're doing that, that's actually just a hindrance to your practice. And then we have skeptical doubt. Let's see, visi, kicha, my guess, how to pronounce it. Spiritual doubt, uncertainty, wavering, indecisiveness, cynicism, inability to place confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So in terms of these five hindrances, there are four ways recommended to deal with them. And I'm going to introduce this kind of, in general, these are the ways that we deal with them, but then I am going to ask folks to take 10 minutes or so to take one of these and come up with like essentially like four different ways to deal with it, to practice with it, to try to move toward where it is not such a hindrance. So the four different ways are what I might call antidote or direct action. So the old Buddhist texts are full of recommendations for what antidotes to apply, things to do. If this is your hindrance, this is what you should do. So it's all very like straightforward and kind of attractive. So for instance, if you are feeling ill will, then you do metta practice. If you are suffering from sloth and torpor, you go out and get some fresh air. I mean, really, literally, that's on the list. We can imagine you could get some exercise, get better sleep. If you are experiencing, you know, restlessness and worry or uncertainty, maybe studying the Dharma. It's interesting that this kind of antidote direct action responses to the hindrances, every one of them include the prescriptions of noble friendship and suitable conversation. So those are like, okay, you know, this hindrance is arising. What am I going to do about it? And I think this is a very typical way for us to respond, right? We're like, oh, I don't want to feel this ill will. I don't want to feel this restlessness and worry. You know, it's getting in the way of my life and practice and meditation. So I'm going to try to do this thing to fix it. And there's a time and a place for that, right? We're perseverating on things. We're just sick with worry, whatever, to do something healthy. Basically, we do in Zen, we're going to do all of these approaches simultaneously. It's not like we only meditate on things, right? We do whatever we can. So that's the first one is that antidote direct action. The second is to contemplate the negative repercussions of this hindrance, to really pay attention. If you sit there and nurture ill will, or you let yourself, you know, dwell in restlessness and worry all night, you know, you feel like this, you don't really figure anything out. A typical one is to, if you're feeling ill will or anger, to contemplate how anger makes you ugly. When you're angry, nobody likes you. Like, there's this whole list of things of like, you know, you're essentially punishing yourself with this anger. So it's like you pick up a glowing ember to, you know, throw at your enemy, but like you're burning yourself as well. So those kinds of things, not exactly my cup of tea, but, and then we have the third, which is seeing through, let's see. So kind of insight into origins of these things and kind of disidentifying with them. So paying attention with mindfulness. So this is what the Buddha recommended with mindfulness. He said, how does a monk practice contemplation on the five hindrances? It says herein monks, for example, so this is true for every one of them. This is just going to use sensual desire for the first example. When sensual desire is present in him, the monk knows, there is sensual desire in me. Or when sensual desire is absent, he knows there is no sensual desire in me. He knows how the arising of non-arisen sensual desire comes to be. He learns to pay attention and be like, ah, look, you know, because of this, I noticed that this hindrance arose in me. He knows how the rejection of the arisen sensual desire comes to be. So he knows like, but then when I did this, that hindrance subsided. And he knows how the non-arising in the future of the sensual desire comes to be. So we learn how to not go down that road. And also, like the very fact that you contemplate this like arising and passing away of these things, and you're kind of my teacher Kyogen would say, like, as soon as you become mindful of something you're experiencing, you're already not entirely caught in it. And you, I mean, you might still be upsetting, but you've taken just a little bit of a step back. So after you do this quite a lot, I think this is quite typical early in practice. We recognize we don't have to experience anger as an I am angry. It's like I am feeling really angry right now, right? That's a very different relationship to it. It's recognizing I'm not always going to feel angry. This is something that arises. This is karma. There are reasons why this arose, and there are things that I can do to allow this to pass. So we had the kind of antidote, direct action. We have contemplating negative repercussions. We have seeing through our mindfulness. And then I guess what I would call the fourth one is insight. What fundamental causes are there seeing through delusions, including our delusion of a separate, inherently existing self? So even when we kind of mastered and we managed not to feel this way anymore, there can be reasons why these hindrances arise that are very deep and spiritual. They have to do with our deep spiritual koans, right? Of lack of understanding of our true self nature, a lack of acceptance of our Buddha nature. So we keep on, getting sucked into remorse, or a lack of appreciation for the inseparability of self and all things, and that therefore we are not in control in some small way, and therefore we cannot lose control in some small way. We're kind of a bigger part of a bigger process. Therefore, restlessness might decrease. So, that fourth is insight. So I just wanted to a little bit from James Ford before we discuss. So as he says, as I've experienced Zen, the great project is not quenching or extinguishing our experiences. As we often find in both the literal translations of Pali texts, as they're plainly represented by many modern Theravadan Buddhists and many Mahayana Buddhists as well. Zen's great project is rather seeing through our experiences in all things. That is, being present without attachment, or holding passionately, but being able to let go when it is time to let go. There is within this sense of seeing through a letting go of the results while living fully with the moment. It's a magic trick humans get to do. In Zen, we call it awakening, seeing the horns of the ox in all their glory. Sadly, in my experience, we also fall back asleep. We forget that we saw those horns, like it was something that happened in a dream, kind of all the time. But with continuous practice, we find a kind of oscillation where each now asleep is sooner or later followed by a now awake that becomes a new birth. And with that, we can live with our grasping and become generous, live with our aversion and see clearly, and live with our certainties and find ourselves endlessly curious. So, yes, let's take a few minutes. Let's take 10 minutes or so. You don't have to go strictly through my four different ways to practice with the hindrances, but let's see.
I've actually.
So I'm sorry that I've blabbed too long, and we don't have a lot of time for reporting back. But let us, how about for each hindrance, let us hear what, like, one thing maybe from each group that discussed it. So I know we had two cloud groups discussing worldly obsession. So, anybody from one of those groups want to just throw out something that you guys, something that struck you as being a good way to practice with it, respond to it. I didn't designate a secretary, but so you're just going to have to jump on in.
Not all at once.
Worldly obsession. Was it that you couldn't come up with a way to deal with it? All right, Ashley.
Everyone, we noted that like a key part of this is just the mindful awareness in the beginning of what you're like craving or wanting. And then some members said having like a kind of a gratitude practice was helpful, so that way you could first become aware of what the worldly obsession is that's calling to you, and then combat that by like reassessing what you already have, so that way you're less inclined to pursue it. And I also thought that like the idea of just noble friendship and discussion was really important, because even just within the discussion itself, I already found myself thinking about a lot of things that tend to take up my attention, that I grasp for, that I hadn't thought about this past week. So I feel like having a good support group or like a spiritual family you can come to and talk to about these things is a good way to combat that. Thank you.
You. Anybody from the other worldly obsession group have anything you want to throw in? Okay, then on to ill will. There was a cloud group that discussed ill will. Any tips?
It's so quiet.
Leah.
Yeah, we talked about a lot of things, but one thing I remember that stuck with me that I don't always consider is when you're dealing with ill will, or we were talking about like feeling angry, sometimes we feel it in our body. And so if you note those bodily feelings of anger and resentment, then just the noting it helps, like for like balling up your fists or bruxism. Gnashing those teeth. If you know the word bruxism, you probably do it. And just those feelings. Now, Stuart, that was a good idea. It's sticking with me. I'm thinking about it still.
Thank you. Okay, then. Sloth and torpor. We have a cloud group and a dirt sender group. Tips on sloth and torpor.
The cloud group actually, for some reason, it arranged no one in that group except for the Doan and the whatever. And so I didn't catch that. So it'll have to be, I'm glad they did it in the thing, but I didn't catch it till we'd already sent out the whole list, the way it arranged the groups.
All right. Courtney from the sloth and torpor group.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing we talked about with sloth and torpor is how just movement, doing something positive, it helps break it. Just talking about how it can come from like an overwhelm, or it can come from like a resistance to wanting to do the work. Like if there's something in us, and so looking at where that's coming from.
Thank you. Restlessness and worry. Do we have a cloud comment on that? Mick.
You know, well, I'll take this one. One of the things that I find interesting about restlessness and worry is that, like, when you do a little bit of introspection, like this one seems to get worse, like with a lot of other ones, like a little bit of introspection about why am I feeling like this, like might tend to help. But I think if you're like, oh man, why am I worrying? Am I a worrying person? Like, what is that? Is this really? And so, for me personally, it was about sort of like finding a little bit of space and really trying to, I guess, gently become aware of what's happening and kind of just like, I mean, this is one of the things that I think has really developed in my practice is just like non-judgmentally looking at the situation and sort of like, you know, not that I need to fix this or I need to stop doing it, but just becoming aware and kind of like letting the solution come from my own desire to live my life in the way that is consistent with my values.
Thank you. Good way to put it. Do we have a restlessness and worry comment from the Dirt Syndrome?
Sure, I'll say something. The first thing that came up was noble friends, which is really sweet, and I think that is really important for this one. And one thing that I said was, sometimes you need the right, the noble part of friends is really important, because sometimes people will kind of enable the, like just kind of tell you what you want to hear. And some friends will give you a reality check, but not in a way that is helpful or kind. And some friends will give you a reality check that just actually does relieve that kind of pressure and feels really nice. And then the other thing that we talked about was shikantaza meditation. It's really helpful here if you can do it in these moments of agitation or rumination. I think it's, for me personally, it's really hard. For others in my group, it was the solution. And yeah, that's kind of what we talked about.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right, on to skeptical doubt. Got somebody from the cloud who say something about skeptical doubt.
Could say something about that. We discussed different ways of not being skeptical, and one was persistence. Just keep doing what you're doing, and results will come. Skepticism will wane, theoretically. Hearing the same thing from different perspectives can maybe help you be convinced or believe. How do you say it? Yeah, saying 50 different things 50 different ways. Kind of open up, your perspective. And I think, Domio, you always say instead of arrow points meeting, you just keep firing arrows till one hits, right?
Thank you. Yeah, Andrew.
So, skeptical that we talked. Do you want to share what you said to start this all off or no?
What did I say?
Oh, just about how you kind of naturally kind of a skeptical, doubtful type person.
Oh,
Do you want to
yeah,
share about?
they know that.
Well, so the example that I personally use, and I don't know if this is, I don't know how helpful this is, but so skeptical doubt. So let's say that someone is doubtful and say the words of the Buddha, and maybe they're doing a lot of reading Buddhist books, trying to figure out what Buddhism is all about, because that's what I did. And so my answer to skeptical doubt was if in this, again, this is just an example, the teachings of the Buddha are removed from you, that's because you're not putting them into practice. And so once you put them into practice, that's where, at least for me, things kind of started to come alive, I guess. And also, I brought up the example of the Buddha himself. Didn't he say something like, "Try these things for yourself. If they don't work, abandon them. Don't take my word for it. You have to put these things into practice."
Thank you very much. Yeah, I think, like Dennis, you made me think. This is one of the values of Sangha and sharing and hearing other people's take on things, right? Because it's not just, you know, y'all believe me or not, right? You might hear somebody else's experience more similar to yours. They just say it in a way that you go, yeah, that makes sense. So that is a great noble friendship. Well, there we go. I do have two podcast episodes on the five hindrances and one on the three poisons. And if you're a fan of, you know, the really systematic Pali Canon stuff, there are, you know, just like lots of stuff about if you have this hindrance and then this is what you should do and this is the prescription for it. Yeah.
I did want to say something about restlessness and worry, something I brought up to the group. As a geriatrician, I deal with people with dementia and also at end of life. And a lot of the instructions we give are for restlessness and agitation. And one of the things that we ask them to do first is to redirect. And so when I think of this, I always think you need to redirect. What other path can you take if you're restless and agitated? Mm-hmm. And so, anyway, it's just that I'd share that with you because that's what we do with our people. We just, you know, they can't identify their agitation, but we can identify our agitation and restlessness. Just have to.
Yeah, and that's why I think somebody mentioned, I don't know, sometimes Zazen isn't the best thing for that kind of thing. If you cannot get yourself off of the perseveration or rumination. I mean, in our form of like, you know, letting go shikantaza, that is a time when you may want to do another form of meditation where it's like, you're going to do metta practice, you're going to do something that redirects the mind. And a matter of fact, I'll just throw this out there and then we'll wrap up. When we are really upset, then we might want to do something like walking meditation, chanting meditation. There's even sutra copying, like, you know, writing, just copying. So you're not thinking or anything. You're just carefully copying the sutras. So other forms of meditation, which can redirect. All right. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Hi, everyone.
Good night.
Good night.